This episode is brought to you by LifeLock. Not everyone is careful with your personal information, which might explain why there's a victim of identity theft every 5 seconds in the U.S. Fortunately, there's LifeLock. LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points a second for threats to your identity. If your identity is stolen, a U.S.-based restoration specialist will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Save up to 40% your first year by visiting LifeLock.com/podcast. Terms apply.
What is up, freaks? Welcome back to Tales from the Crypt. It's your boy Marty Bent here on a Wednesday for this week's edition of Rabbit Hole Recap with Matt Odell and a very special guest who brought a very special drink with him, Bitcoin Sign Guy, who's supplying the clarified milk punch tonight. Welcome to the pod.
Ahoy. How's everyone doing?
It's good to be here, guys. This is a weird drink you brought us.
Yeah.
You want to explain this drink?
What you brought us, this concoction.
So this is a clarified milk punch. It's made with port and black tea, and then rum. But the real trick of it is you put all of these ingredients on top of milk, and then you add lemon juice, and the lemon juice curdles the milk. And it makes it coagulate into curds that then you can strain off. And so you're left with the whey taste of milk, but it's a clear ruby-colored drink. And so it has a creaminess to it, but it's perfectly clear and there's no lactose or something like that.
Is this a traditional holiday drink? Is that what you made it?
I think, yeah, it's a traditional European holiday beverage. So I figured...
I hope it's not strong because it doesn't taste like alcohol at all.
It's very strong.
Well... Here we go.
It doesn't look like milk at all. There's no milk looking.
Looks like fruit punch.
That's the curds. They're all strained out through a cheesecloth.
It's pretty cool. We learn new things every day.
Learn new things, try new experience.
Just if you're a future guest on the Rabbit Hole Recap and you come to join us, this is, you know, what you're up against. It'd be nice if you also brought us a custom beverage.
It's the type of cultured aesthetic we're going for here.
There you go. It's beautiful.
So
I'm also drinking scotch next to it, though, because I'm not fully sold on it.
Yeah, not sure how the combo is going to work out towards the end of the episode, but we'll see. We'll see where it takes us. But let's get back onto the subject at hand. It's I think the 15th or 16th edition of Rabbit Hole Recap. We'd
be killing it.
The three of us attended the Soho Forum earlier this week. It was a debate between Drs. Larry White and Kenneth Rogoff. Larry White is a free banking evangelist, and Ken Rogoff, I guess most of the listeners of this podcast would call him a statist. That is
state evangelist.
Yeah, state evangelist, yes. But it was an interesting debate, and I really liked the forum and the way it went going in. I was telling you guys earlier, I was like totally like down on Rogoff, obviously, because he wants to institute NERP and stuff. But like after he explained
it,
wants to ban cash and stuff like that. But he did make some compelling arguments. Not that I agree with them, but they were compelling, I could see, to some people. What'd you guys think?
I mean, I think his, you know, like, I guess his arguments are decent enough, but like cryptocurrencies make them irrelevant.
Yeah,
because they just, I think the cat's out of the bag. They can't stop us. Like, ideally, they would like everyone to fall in line and use a digital money that's easily trackable, that's, you know, censorable. But I think also that
central bank digital currencies are the most direct way for central banks to apply negative interest rates. So it doesn't, they could apply negative interest rates across all held money in the money supply, not just deposits at the Federal Reserve. So the sort of mechanism that he advocates here is, in case people don't know, is that when you have cash in an economy and the central bank tries to impose negative rates, people will just withdraw and flee to cash. And that dampens the efficacy of the negative interest rate. And so, of course, I think that this is a lever of power that central banks shouldn't have, even if it is, as he states, and I somewhat agree, that it is probably the most elegant form of monetary policy. I would prefer it, or I would probably predict that its efficacy would be better than, say, quantitative easing. But I still think that constitutionally it would constitute a taking and would, I don't know, have other issues thereof.
I mean, the bigger issue is that, you know, Bitcoin exists. So so they
have to compete.
Like, the whole time he was up there making his argument, I was like, this guy is the best Bitcoin promoter there is. You know, you have people out there saying, you know, it's desirable to ban all large cash bills, to move to a completely digital system so you can easily implement NERP and basically take your money, take your wealth. That is like, is there any better Bitcoin advertisement than that? Like, that's the best thing you could hear.
Yeah, no, and I completely agree with you guys. And to give the other half of the debate, Dr. White's perspective from the free ranking perspective, you freaks will actually learn a lot more about this next week when I post the episode with Matthew Mazinkius from the Crypto Voices podcast. We went over this thoroughly. But Dr. White would argue that we should have a free banking system in which private banks compete with each other and are able to create their own notes that are backed by potentially Bitcoin reserves in the future, and they can compete on their own merits in the market, and people can choose which money they want to use and which bank they want to trust. And there was actually, I learned from Matthew, in Canada between, I believe it was like 1816 and 1920, that 60-year period, they had a true free banking system, and they were actually affected more heavily than the U.S. was during the Great Depression. But with that being said, none of their banks failed, which was very interesting to me. I did not know that.
Right. So I would highly recommend that any listeners who are more interested in learning about these, I guess, select periods in history of extreme banking stability, read, you know, several of the books by George Selgin, the scholar at the Cato Institute. He's, I guess, the leading expert on all of those. So go there if you want to learn more.
Yeah. No, and that's another thing I think that Bitcoin does brilliantly is has people thinking about these differing theories and these differing schools of thoughts, whereas maybe a decade ago, this type of conversation wasn't happening. So very encouraging Monday night. There was a lot of young faces in the crowd.
A good Bitcoin crew there.
Yeah, very good Bitcoin crew too.
Very solid Bitcoin crew.
Bitcoiner showed up in mass. There was developers. Pierre was there.
They called out Bitcoin sign guy. They're like, we got a celebrity.
Bitcoin sign guy asked the question. They recognized him.
Yeah, they recognized him right away. They're like, that's the guy. That's the guy. That was fucking cool. The other thing to note is that Larry White is
important.
He said everything right. And I went in there, actually, one of the main reasons I was going was to see you guys. But the second main reason I was going was to heckle Larry White. And literally, I agreed with every single thing that came out of his mouth. But like, you have to be skeptical of him because he's an advisor for Initiative Q, which they have his name on the website, all over the website. He didn't mention it once, but he did shill Beam, which is the Mimblewimble implementation that is like more.
It's a Grin competitor.
But it's more corporate, right? And of course, they have Larry White as an advisor to it. So be wary a little bit.
Maddie from Crypto Voices actually had him on the podcast a few months ago. So was able to like walk up to him and approach him. And he called him out on it. And Dr. White's excuse was, hey, let a hundred flowers bloom. So I guess that's his perspective.
Well, that's the strongest altcoin founder advisor defense is... let the free market play out. I mean, that's why I'm not specifically against altcoins from an overarching perspective. I just think the individual advisors are taking advantage of dumb people. Mm-hmm. But I think from an overall market perspective, you know, let them all fucking go for it.
Yeah, it's meritocracy at the end of the day. And I would argue that we believe Bitcoin will win out in the long run. We'll see, though. Back to the news items of the week. Vercoin, big 51% attack this week.
It's the fourth one.
Fourth one.
Super deep.
Matt, you are this is your bread and butter. I'll let you take this one.
Well, I'm glad that like people are starting to fucking wake up to it. You know, I haven't shut up about this for over a year now. I mean, the market completely completely disregarded any kind of chain security or censorship resistance, which is the main value prop of all of these fucking things. And I think the hash war, the so-called hash war with Bitcoin Cash also, you know, brought it to light a lot. You know, Bitcoin Cash ABC ended up having to institute centralized checkpointing system, which is, you know, you're just throwing the baby out with the bathwater. You're not really solving anything. So with Vertcoin, they're a famous ASIC-resistant coin. ASIC resistance is futile. You can't trustlessly put in ASIC resistance because eventually someone will make a specific chip that outperforms a general purpose chip. This is just, that's how things are. That's the natural order of the world. Mm-hmm. You can make something purpose built that will outperform something general purpose. So the only way to do it is to manually constantly fork out ASICs, and that introduces centralization risk. That's, you know, what Monero has been doing. And Vertcoin, because they're such a shit coin, they were like really slow about doing that. So supposedly people think that some ASICs were made, and because most ASIC manufacturers would never make a Vertcoin ASIC because they're afraid it's going to get forked out, they don't have like vital, they don't have true competition there with ASICs. It was like super trivial for them to get 51% attacked, and basically money gets stolen from exchanges in that case. So any exchange that has has weak chains connected to it and no KYC, because that's important, can get exploited from
yes.
these kind of these
so our boy at AustStorms on Twitter actually tweeted out this scenario, which is creating an Anon account on insert Anon exchange here or exchange without KYC here, send all coins, market by Bitcoin, withdraw Bitcoin, 51% deep reorg whatever altcoin you originally sent, and you basically get your money back and
yeah, I mean the
Bitcoin for free.
The big one you would attack in the day would have been Shapeshift, but now they have KYC. So now it's basically Binance. You know, Binance gets around it a little bit because they have pretty stringent limits if you have a non-verified account. I think it's like 2 Bitcoin you can withdraw per day. Mm-hmm. So like if you're trying to do a sizable attack, like that's going to end up being pretty expensive. If you did it to someone like Coinbase, they literally have your address.
Well,
right? Like your home address. Well, they could just go to your house and be like, dude, you just stole a bunch of money from me.
Well, this brings up an interesting point about Bitcoin attack vectors. And a lot of people allude to the possibility of a future state attack on Bitcoin in particular. But what we're finding with these types of scenarios is it might be an easier attack vector for the state to go after these exchanges via these reorg attacks, basically bankrupt the exchanges and disrupt the on and off ramps if they wanted an easier way to attack Bitcoin instead of attacking it directly.
I mean, there's... Look, I think the exchange that probably right now has the most ire of the U.S. federal government is BitMEX. Mm-hmm. And BitMEX solves it quite elegantly. They only allow Bitcoin deposits and withdrawals, and they only process them once a day for withdrawals. Mm-hmm. So they have a very simple process. It's only dependent on the most secure chain, and that attack vector is you know very limited to them. It's more like these shitcoin bucket shops that would be vulnerable to that type of attack.
It's a little chilly this time of year in New York. Should we take a field trip to the Seychelles?
I think we should. I don't have a case to bring, but I'd definitely go.
You have no case. You have no business in the Seychelles.
Where is the Seychelles? It's like the eastern coast of Africa.
Yeah, east coast of Africa. It's also near where. If you play Metal Gear Solid 5, the snake's base, the Diamond Dogs, they're off the coast of the Seychelles.
That's probably where Arthur got it from.
Yeah, absolute closest thing to Ancapistan right now.
We're going to get yelled at for levels. Make sure you're bringing the mic close to your face. Oh, but this is true. Another.
You had so many audio files who listened to your show.
Yeah. Very sensitive subject on this podcast in particular.
Bitcoiners are maximalists in all different sorts of hobbies and shapes and sizes.
This is true. Staying on the Vertcoin story, to get back on topic, Zuku ruffled a lot of feathers today, saying this is a serious problem. Nakamoto Consensus is failing.
POW is dead.
Vertcoin is currently being 51% attacked, and he's trying to conflate all of POW to Vertcoin being susceptible to an attack, which I don't agree with. And there's an argument to be made that even though Vertcoin got 51% attack, Nakamoto Consensus did not fail.
You know, I'm a little bit, I mean, first of all, Nakamoto Consensus is working exactly like designed.
Exactly.
you know, I'm a little torn because, like, I've been screaming from the rooftops that people aren't taking security seriously. And, you know, because of Vertcoin, Zuku's finally seems to be taking it seriously. So I'm happy about that. Of course, the human condition is the second you take something seriously, you go to the full fucking extreme and just say nothing is secure. You know, these are false equivalencies. Like, it's infinitely more difficult to attack Bitcoin than it is to attack Vertcoin. It is even infinitely more difficult to attack Zcash than it is to attack Vertcoin. And the difference between Zcash and Bitcoin is also infinite. So there's like a very, there's a lot of fucking nuance here.
And putting my conspiracy hat on for a second here, Zuku is the leader of Zcash, a project which is pretty contingent on its founder reward or dev reward that's baked
into its founder reward.
Founder reward baked into its block reward. There's a lot of speculation that they would like to increase or expand or extend that founder's reward further into the future than was previously accounted for. And if they're not able to do that, basically another way to create the revenue that is produced by the founder's reward would be to transition to proof of stake and become a main staker in the network.
And then they can maintain the... And besides that, this whole time, Zuku has been part of this war against ASICs where they don't explicitly say that they're going to fork out ASICs, but they have all this conversations with, oh, we want it to be GPU friendly. Oh, maybe proof of stake. Oh, maybe we'll change the reward. Maybe we'll do... And all these things discourage security spend on your network. They discourage people from making more ASICs. There's a critical point there in the beginning where you need multiple manufacturers to come in and produce ASICs. Otherwise, you end up in a super centralized situation. And I just think he's been very hypocritical in that regard because he hasn't taken it seriously with Zcash. And then all of a sudden, you know, some shitcoin, you know, Vertcoin gets attacked that has basically no action, no activity on it. And now he's like, it's just like completely dead. So it does kind of feel like a POS shill. And then the other thing is, the weakness for Zcash isn't Nakamoto consensus. The biggest, if you're talking about state resistance, the biggest weakness for Zcash is that Zuku and the whole Zcash company can be thrown in jail if they don't fucking comply. And all the investors, Barry Silber and all the rich investors, they can just get fucking thrown in jail. They're the weakness. You know, I think Zcash is questionably secure to begin with just, you know, POW. But I think it is completely way more weak
that is
in terms of
by social
values. Oh yeah, their organizational structure, right? Like it makes it is way weaker than the POW. Because at least they have ASICs.
Yeah. BSG.
The fact that they have ASICs is big.
Any thoughts on the subject?
Well, things that are valuable usually require sweat, equity to be invested. I think that if you have an aversion to proof of work, you might be the type of person who thinks that in the Soviet Union, your job would be anime appraiser.
Oh, I fucking love you.
Cheers.
And that was talking Vertcoin. So, hey, just be aware. These weak chains can be attacked. They are being attacked, and I only expect these attacks to continue and increase in the future.
But you mentioned a Barry Silbert. I saw today, I think that Grayscale now has 210,000 Bitcoin.
This wasn't on the list. Thank you for bringing
it up. In their coffers. I mean, that's 10% of
1%.
Excuse me. Yeah, thank you for clarifying. Running away with the math here. But that's a lot of Bitcoin. That's 1% of the future maximum supply. And I guess that would give them an incentive to change Bitcoin to proof of stake. But I guess that's not on the table yet.
Yeah, there is a big discussion to have around the ethics of how much coin these funds hold.
Well, I mean, first of all, like Bitcoin's not moving to proof of stake.
I guess my... I'm not suggesting that we debate that. My question is more is the fact that they hold that much Bitcoin a vulnerability? Where is the, if there is a vulnerability in that, you know, let's
Freaks, I'm sorry for the levels. I know you're going to complain. Like, I'm looking at
them. We have two mics, and we're passing the mic in between me and BSG, so I apologize.
Yeah. No, but that I am Bitcoin selling. I'm happy you brought that subject up. It is an important one. 1% of the whole Bitcoin supply is now owned by Grayscale Investments.
Well, I think the better argument is that these types of funds are going to exist no matter what. It mm-hmm. makes sense from an efficiency point of view. You know, you have one person custodying it, and everyone gets to trade it on their TD Ameritrade account or whatever the fuck they want to trade on. So it's going to happen no matter what. Also, custodial exchanges, no matter what, going to hold a shit ton of Bitcoin, like Coinbase and stuff. So the real question is, if you're a proof of stake proponent, are you comfortable with these funds, you know, being major, you know, major elements of the security of your chain? Are you comfortable with these funds having like actual direct influence? Because I personally don't think they have much influence over the direction of Bitcoin, because it's proof of work and not proof of stake. I think SegWit2x proved that. You know, there was plenty of opportunities for us to do some kind of stakeholder vote type of situation that Ethereum did when they pushed through the DAO fork with only 5% of the vote, but we didn't. Everyone was against that, even the major Bitcoin stakeholders. And I think that it was a big turning point where it doesn't matter how much Bitcoin you own. That's not, you know, where you get the say in the network.
Yeah, very good point. Yeah, so be aware of that as well, freaks. Very interesting news.
That's also good news, I think. I would say that GBTC owning, you know, 1% of the supply is probably good news, because it's the only exchange-traded thing for Americans, really, except for the ETN, which is like kind of around the side, you know. It's not legit as much for Americans.
Yeah,
like, I don't think it's available as many platforms.
A lot of Bitcoin by New Yorker, held by New Yorkers, the Winklevi, they have 1% too. Wasn't that their goal back in the day, to get to 1% of all Bitcoin?
Could have been.
I think
their goal is just to dunk on Zuck. So whatever amount of Bitcoin they need to hold to get to that level, I hope they make it.
You got this, Winklevi.
Actually, yeah, Facebook's fucked, man. Have you been reading what's going on there?
Fuck Facebook.
We're not gonna dive too much into that subject.
Delete Facebook.
I just wanted to say,
I know that we're a little bit hypocritical with Twitter, but when you use Twitter, you should use a NIM and not show your name and shit. And also, I know we're hypocritical about that as well, but not Bitcoin Sign Guy. So he's got that going for us. And as far as we're concerned, you know, we're doing it for you guys.
Yeah.
Taking one for the team.
Next subject, we're going to go from Bitcoin and crypto specific to macro. We've talked about this before in the past. I've talked about this in Marty's Bent many times in the past, but the growing trend of countries looking to denominate their oil's future contracts in their native currencies. We've talked about China and Russia creating energy deals between each other with oil contracts based in yuan and rubles. It seems that the Eurozone, the ECB or the Euro Council, whoever makes these decisions for them, is looking to do the same. They would like to have oil contracts based in the Euro too. ArbDout was tweeting about this today. So this is just like a growing trend that I think is a huge macro development to pay attention to, especially if you're a Bitcoiner, because basically the petrodollar underpins the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency of the world. And when you have a scenario in which the reserve currency is in question, typically throughout history, the safest commodities that just so happen to double as money are apolitical. So gold, and there's an argument to be made that now Bitcoin exists and could be that vehicle as well.
Yeah, well, Not to change the subject, but in macro terms, Bitcoin faces probably its most important test coming up, which will be when the economy, as it's currently, you know, cooking along, eventually takes a correction. Will Bitcoin be will it trade counter to, I guess, whatever impending market correction we have? So we're sort of laying the groundwork for Bitcoin to be able to pump in spite of this, but everyone will need to buy Bitcoin when stock market starts tanking. Jill Carlson had a good thread about crypto in general being a canary in the coal mine for a impending macro crisis, but
Yeah, well,
form your own opinions on this.
Yes, and I actually think Pierre had a very, very good take on this. He tweeted out yesterday or 2 days ago, I believe, my contrarian view. Bitcoin is not a risk-on, reach-for-yield asset, nor is it a risk-off, safe-haven asset. Those are just two of many narratives. Bitcoin sits outside of that dichotomy as a growth currency with an exchange rate driven by endogenous properties and adoption drivers, which I thought was a very good explanation.
I mean, we have our own cycle. Bitcoin has its own cycle.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, so it depends on when these macro events hit Bitcoin in its own cycle, right? Like if we're overextended and we're in a bull market and all the shitcoin and EOS is trading at $18 and Multicoin's giving out a bullish thesis that they're pretending that didn't exist now.
Are they really?
Yeah, they were short the whole time and they made bank. If you're in a bull cycle and you're overextended, like the price will probably come down and come down harder than usual, you know, and if you're in a bear cycle and sellers are exhausted, you know, then maybe Bitcoin doesn't get affected as much in these kind of risk off scenarios. I mean, I would be hesitant to, I mean, you mentioned the Jill Carson thread and I would be
Carlson.
Yeah, I would be hesitant to say that we're a canary in the coal mine. I mean, I think Bitcoin had a blow off top that it's had, you know, the last three times, and that's what happens. You know, I'm not sure if the macro situation had that much of an effect this time around.
I'm simply saying that Bitcoin's reputation will be determined in the next macro cycle where people discover whether it is truly a risk on or risk off asset. And if that we can get the fundamentals to the point where Bitcoin can move counter to the macro cycle, then, you know, all the better for us.
Yeah, no, it's a good sort of shining beacon in the future to aim towards. And so something actually good point to bring up. I say this a lot on the podcast and in the newsletter is that my biggest gripe with the space in particular is the collective impatience. Everybody wants everything out of the box. There is a caveat to that. Like you have to balance the impatience with the need for a certain sense of urgency to build out these tools and make them so that they have strong defenses against outside attackers.
Yeah, we have to be in a rush, but also patient.
Yes. Yeah. Right.
Right.
Yeah, a lot of you freaks might yell at me for saying, like, what the fuck, Marty? You've been telling us to be patient the whole time. But there is some nuance where, yes, there is a certain amount of urgency that you should be thinking about as well.
Agreed. Yeah. You want to be preemptive. You want to be thinking through, like, all the different scenarios. You know, I remember a couple months ago, you know, now we're talking about if someone can rent hash rate on NiceHash for like $800 and 51% attack your shitcoin. Like it's this big revelation that didn't exist. Like 8 months ago, 6 months ago when we attacked Syria, when the US government attacked Syria and we launched 130 cruise missiles at them or whatever it was, I was like, can your chain handle 130 cruise missiles? Like these are things that we should be thinking about. Like we should be building for the future where you need to be resistant to that, you know, that level of kind of attack.
Mm-hmm.
So fun fact, those cruise missiles were actually Tomahawk missiles. And less than a week ago, I went with my grandfather, who was in the Air Force, to the commissioning of a new Arleigh Burke class destroyer in Boston Shipyard. And I saw those Tomahawk missile cells. So I can say that I've seen them recently and they're all ready to go. And yeah, the struggle is real.
They exist. No,
as they say.
It's crazy, well, man.
I'm glad you're assessing our threat model for us.
No,
we appreciate that.
And a lot of people are like, oh, you guys are fucking crazy paranoid, but this is the type of mentality that you have to have and as a Bitcoiner, you should have.
If you actually care about so-called open finance and, you know, censorship-resistant networks, state-resistant networks, like, this is what you have to talk about. Like, you can't have, a decentralized financial global network and allow one country to be able to take, you know, easily take it down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess it comes down to how far are you willing to go to keep the Bitcoin network operational. So it may be a counterfactual, but for example, if the government is going to start kicking in doors where IP addresses are located that have Bitcoin nodes running, you know, what do you do in that situation? Get a safe house, you know, start stockpiling. Also, yeah, never have your whole stash of bug out stuff at your primary residence. Go listen to Jameson Lopp. Get a secondary location that you can retreat to. You'll always be taken by surprise the first time. You know, go make a standoff, like a Bundy standoff, on your Bitcoin node elsewhere. Don't do it at your primary residence.
Oh, you're incredible.
I'm glad we had you here.
Well, staying on this sort of type macro topic, what's going on in Paris? I said this earlier this week, like Paris, obviously the Paris riots, the Yellow Vest movement, the Yellow Jacket movement, whatever you want to refer to it as. It seems as though Macron's presidency is not going as well as planned for him. They have precipitously raised taxes, and it seems like the middle class is revolting. We actually found a picture of one of those Yellow Vest rememing Bitcoin Sign Guys meme, buy Bitcoin, in the middle of the protest.
There's only one thing I have to say to those protesters, and that's let them drive electric. I don't know. Whether Macron is a latter-day Marie Antoinette, TBD, but I certainly would love to meet the guy who wrote "Buy Bitcoin" on his yellow vest. So,
how does it feel to see your meme spreading?
It feels good, man. It feels like I wasn't alone doing it. I don't know. I would encourage more people. If you're at a pivotal moment in history, just consider.
Well, let's talk about this. So I brought this up earlier. I'm not trying to directly analogize this to the Arab Spring, but it has a very similar feel, where it seems like a group of people in a particular section of the world are very unhappy with their government and the people leading them. I think the straw that broke the camel's back this time around was a price rise in the gasoline taxes in particular, which forced the truck drivers to protest and sort of tumbled from there. And the Arab Spring, some people would argue, I mean, it's the last snowflake to fall in an avalanche, but that was commodity prices rising there as well in the form of wheat. Obviously, there's going to be two different outcomes to these movements, but it's very similar, like fever, and it seems to be spreading in Europe in particular. I've heard stuff in Italy and Greece as well happening. So it's just an interesting, tumultuous period of history right now.
Well, I guess the theme, and you know, the people that write for The Economist like to, you know, hold it with a gloved hand at a distance and say, oh, it's populism, and they talk about it like it's some virus. But I would say overall it's a realization that there won't be a one size fits all globalist formula for how societies should be run. And I guess right now this is manifesting in the breakdown of the European project.
Can I add something?
No. Yes, of course you
can. I mean, so I would say I there's two things I have to say. First of all, the French are very good about rioting. So, like, let's not, you know, we'll see how this unfolds.
Somebody hit a long knife in a baguette.
But that was passed down from generation to generation. But one sec. Anyway, my point is that it's good to see that they're rioting. I wish Americans were more apt to do that when
we're not trying to incite a riot on Rabbit Hole Recap here, people.
And then the second thing is, that was an interesting, I think it was the editorial we were reading where they were talking about, Macron is childless, and like how many leaders in Europe are childless, and they don't.
Childless.
Yeah.
Not childish.
No, not childish.
He doesn't have children, yes.
Childless.
He has not. Yeah.
Lacks no children.
Is he married to like a 70-year-old?
He's married to his teacher.
Yeah.
And I think Merkel doesn't have kids.
None of them.
Right. May doesn't have kids in Great Britain. Mm-hmm. Theresa May doesn't have kids, and they like went through like a bunch of the
Jean-Claude Juncker.
Mm-hmm. Jean-Claude Juncker, the head of the European Council.
I think he's bare branches as well. So, yeah, in case you didn't know, you know, Bitcoin is pro-natalist.
No, I just think you should have skin in the game. Like, I feel like the incentives are misaligned there if you don't have, like, future generations that you care about.
Directly in your bloodline. Very interesting point. It's a social aspect. Humans are weird, and we have very weird tendencies, and we should be very hyper-cognizant and hyper-alert of how we organize ourselves and the amount of control of our individuality that we give over to the state.
And just that, I think it's pretty cool that, like, now we have the option to opt out non-violently. If you don't trust your government with your money, with your wealth, you can buy Bitcoin and hold Bitcoin now.
Yeah, great tweet by Pierre. I think he most recently pointed it out that, you know, we have hash wars now, whereas we had trench warfare 100 years ago. So yeah. Steady improvement.
I mean, but I would argue that the future hash wars are going to involve guns and missiles and destroyers and all that stuff.
Well, hopefully we get to a point where it's decentralized enough where the cost of attack is so much, or not even that it's so much, that it would be a Pyrrhic victory at some point.
You don't think nations will go after go to war over shitcoins?
I don't know. I don't know, God. Hopefully, I mean, these are incompetent nations. Like, I think we're going to beat them in the playing field of meritocracy. I don't think they're going to be able to create a competitor that's even worth fighting over.
I think the real thing is the game theory between nations, the prisoner's dilemma of, you know, nations that aren't the U.S. that have lesser stake in the monetary status quo would be incentivized to, you know, harbor Bitcoin nodes and miners in their country instead of, you know, they would be willing to sacrifice having their own sovereign currency to at least, you know, be on the leading edge of the Bitcoin wave and you benefit from that. So I see Russia and China probably as being the two countries that, you know, they're sort of aggressively authoritarian in this moment, but if they could be the first two to prop up Bitcoin and benefit thereof, I think that they would take that trade-off.
Yeah, we actually had Carpe Noctem give us an update on, I mean, you can go to CoinDance and check this, but he brought it to our attention, the local Bitcoin's volume in Venezuela is on the rise again. I think it hit its highest volume day last week.
Yeah, and a lot of those people are corrupt government individuals.
That's true.
I mean, and the other thing is let's look at something like, people love comparing cryptocurrency to the internet, right? So people said that the internet was going to be the downfall of these authoritarian regimes, specifically China, but then also later Russia, when we realized that, you know, the wall falling wasn't as big of a deal as people thought it was, and they were receding back into authoritarianism. They not only did the internet not destroy their societies, because people said it was going to open up information and everything, they leveraged it to make themselves more powerful. You know, like, China is a fucking expert at it. Russia is pretty good. It's not as good as China, you know, but they're pretty fucking good at leveraging it and using it to control their populace, to control other populaces. And it's in their self-interest to do that with Bitcoin as well.
Yeah. No, that's beware. That's it's something that it exists, and it's a heavy realization to come to and have that conversation with yourself. Is it worth it? I think in the long run it is. But we should also be, again, cognizant of the social and technical attack vectors and take that deeply into consideration.
When it comes to nation states, they have to either adapt or die.
It's just true. Away from the macro, back to the technical. Pierre, we've been talking about pretty frequently throughout this podcast, is builder too. He's a very good commentator, and he's building shit. He built basically a node package, would you say?
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, explain it. You've been playing around with it. I have not yet. I don't have a Windows computer. So
yeah, so we've been talking about the at home nodes, you know, the Casa node and the noddle.it, where it's just a plug and play node that you plug into your router. Pierre's idea is let's make it as simple as possible for you to use your own computer to run both a Bitcoin full node and a Lightning node. And he created this one-click launcher that we'll link to in the show notes. And I played with it this weekend because I wanted to test it out. So if you guys have any issues or whatever when you try and use it, you can ask me for help. If I can't help you, Pierre is happy to help as well, which is also really fucking cool, and props to him for that. So basically it installs a Bitcoin node for you, full node. It installs LND, so you have a Lightning node. And then from that point, I installed Zap, which is Jack Mahler's Jack Mahler's Lightning wallet. And fucking slick. This wallet was like super, super fucking slick. And I opened a couple channels with that. And then I connected it to Joule, which is that internet that browser extension we talked about. And then I went to Satoshi's place and I was able to successfully pay with my own Lightning node.
Thanks for pumping the pod.
All through that. And it was fucking, it is very close. We're closer than people realize. It is still, most people might have one or two troubleshooting issues. You know, we'll help you work through that. But the vision is there. You know, once you have that all set up, which Pierre made as easy as possible right now, and it's going to only get easier as he refines it and as, you know, we troubleshoot things. Once you have that set up, it's just two clicks. I went to Satoshi's place. When it gave up my charge, you click the QR code, and it just, the extension automatically reads it. It just pops up, and then you press OK, put in your password, and you're good to go.
What did you draw, though, on Satoshi's place?
Oh, I pumped the pod. I put a TFT. This is why I had, I forget what the term is, but I said Litecoin instead of Lightning.
Was
Freudian slip, because I did two things when I went on to Satoshi's place. They had Charlie Lee's, that meme of Charlie Lee where he's like the Litecoin Star Wars guy or whatever. I don't know, like the anime, the magic internet friends.
Yeah.
So I X'd that out. And then I wrote tftc.io on top. That was my contribution.
You Bitcoin terrorist.
And it was pretty cool. It was the future. I felt like I was in the future, you know?
Yeah. No. Like you said, two clicks. And like I said, after attending the BitDevs meetup, you were not at the meetup when you demoed.
No, right? I miss us playing tennis.
Yeah, it was like magical.
We won the match. And like it was you important.
Said, we're very close. Yes, it's not perfect yet, but you can. The vision is there. And it's just refining and iterating on the vision.
I had it under my fingertips. Like, I literally did it, right? And I didn't have to trust anyone. That's so fucking cool. I think, you know, it's fucking dope. Jewel's really cool.
Yeah, we all need ways to automate our podcast feuds.
It's actually going into Anchor. The hosting are very generous and, I would say, forward-thinking podcast hosting service going in tomorrow to talk Bitcoin with them. We'll see how it goes. Yeah, so definitely check out Pierre's node launcher. Test it out. Hook it up to Joule. Hook it up to Zap. Hook it up to whatever you can.
Yeah, we're going to put the guide. We'll put the guide in the show notes. You have any issues, let us know. It's on Mac, Windows, Linux. I've done it on both Linux and Windows, so I can help you out with that.
Oh, I didn't know it was on Mac. I would have tried it out if I knew it was on Mac.
Yeah, I intentionally booted up an old Windows box just to do the whole thing on Windows so I could walk people through it if I need to. And I just wanted to say thanks to all these people that like made this happen. Jack Mahlers, Willowburn, Pierre, Lightning Koala for Satoshi's Place. Like, you guys are the real MVPs. That's pretty fucking badass.
Shout out to the true MVPs out there. We're always thinking of you. Matt, give us a Wasabi UX update. What's going on?
It's cool. They made it nicer. You know, we have a Telegram chat where we all reduce the anonymity set by talking about it together. And we have been working through the UX. And the UX is much more user-friendly. I think this is the type of wallet that, don't be scared, guys. It is, you know, I want us all to have a Lightning node on our computers and a Bitcoin full node. But that previous segment might be a little bit more intensive for some of you guys. Wasabi's not. You literally just install it. There's no syncing. You put a little bit amount of Bitcoin in there. You know, you have to put it in at least 0.1, and it makes it more private for you. It helps hide blockchain analytics. You can't it makes it much more difficult to connect your transactions, and you pay them a very small fee, and it's set up in a trustless way. So even if they're compromised, they can't take your privacy.
Yeah,
and I think it's important. So whenever you take money from an exchange, it's connected to your name and address and stuff. You use Cash App, you use, you know, don't use Coinbase, but you use Coinbase, and then you pull your Bitcoin out. That Bitcoin transaction is forever connected to your name and your ID and all this other stuff. And any other transactions you make along the way will always be tracked based on that initial. You'll have plausible deniability, but they'll have a pretty good idea. And so Wasabi breaks that connection. So you transfer to Wasabi. And then someone mentioned this on Twitter. Right now, you can't directly withdraw from Coinbase or Cash App directly to Wasabi, because Wasabi uses the new address standard, which is BEC32. So you have to withdraw to either Trezor, Electrum, or Samurai, and then you send it to Wasabi, and then Wasabi will end that connection. And then from Wasabi, you can send it to cold storage or your hardware wallet or wherever.
Yeah, and I can say with a certain amount of certainty that I believe Cash App has BEC32 on the roadmap.
Rumor is it's coming, guys.
Yeah. So just be on the lookout for that. Death Spiral. Big topic of discussion for the last week. I'm fucking sick of it. Let's just hit it quickly. You describe what people are assuming may happen in Death Spiral scenario, and why the difficulty adjustment in Bitcoin's incentives may prevent this.
The Death Spiral is a fear that people have been proclaiming about for over a half decade now. And the idea is that the price falls so quickly that miners stop mining because it's not profitable. And then we have either no blocks being mined, or we have very few and far between blocks being mined. The difficulty adjustment is literally there, so that doesn't happen. You know, every 2016 blocks, it self-adjusts either down or up based on how much hash power there is. To make it, if hash power is going down, if hash rate is going down, price is going down, then the difficulty makes it more profitable for the existing miners that still exist there, and then they find an equilibrium.
Yes, and the notion that every miner is going to turn their miner off at a certain price point is naive, I would say, to a certain extent.
The worst notion is people that try and pretend that there is a price point, because there isn't. Every miner has different fucking costs.
Exactly.
And different situation that they're in.
Exactly. So, like, imagine being a miner, just expended a bunch of capital, and you just so happen to turn them on, like, the last 2 weeks. Like, you're not going to turn your miners off and lose that.
Right, or there's people that are mining because it's the most censorship-resistant way to get Bitcoin. You know, like, it's way easier to get Bitcoin from mining, and you can even get it anonymously, where you can't do that if you have to buy from an exchange.
Yeah, there's two critical points. One being the cash break even, whether you're literally making money on every, you know, whether Bitcoin that you mine. And then second, whether all-inclusive your ROI is positive or negative. So you could have a negative ROI but have positive
cash,
and it would still be in your best interest to mine, because you would want to recoup your ROI.
Your initial investment, yeah.
And also, you know, that critical number, you could just take a value approach to that and say, okay, well, I think fair value for a Bitcoin is over $1 million. And if you've, you know, budgeted for that ahead of time, you know,
yeah.
Who's to say that you're mining unprofitably?
Those are some fun books. I like to value Bitcoin at $1 million. That's what I use for my own personal holdings.
You bear.
there's a couple other things.
Oh, I had another thing to add. Yes. And then these miners, they have instruments through which they can hedge.
Right, we have the shorts.
They could hedge their investments in the financial markets.
Like. So the people on the other side say they use the secondary markets as an argument for why the game theory is broken, and they say, you know, the miner doesn't care about destroying the network because he can short it at the same time. But then they completely disregard the use of shorts to hedge price risk, which, you know, smart miners will be doing. Mm-hmm. And it's really great that we have a more mature ecosystem in that regard. You could actually use regulated shorts now. You know, you don't have to just use BitMEX or OK Casino. And then the other thing is miners only get paid after 100 blocks. It takes 100 blocks for their Coinbase reward to mature. So they're incentivized to continue the system. They have locked up return that's also locked up to get to the next difficulty adjustment. You also have, in a worst case scenario, you have two things happen. You have fees will build up because blocks are slow. So either people trying to dump because they think Bitcoin's in a death spiral will be using really high fees to send to exchanges. But you'll also have that in combination with probably rich Bitcoiners sending high fee transactions almost as a bribe to get miners to get us to the next difficulty adjustment. And then in some kind of worst case scenario, even worse than that, we could fork and change the difficulty down if we absolutely had to. And that is not an ideal situation, and we will probably never have to do that. But it's important to say that because every single person complaining about the current state of affairs is advocating for a fork to change it. So no matter what, like, your solution is going to require a fork. So in the worst case scenario, we can actually do that, and we can change the difficulty adjustment. It's not an issue.
Yeah. And all these arguments neglect the historical precedent that is there were miners for 2 years when Bitcoin had no value, and there have historically been sort of ideological miners like Slush, for example, that have seen themselves as arbiters of the network and will provide this hash rate at a loss.
I think the market price for Bitcoin on exchanges is simply a thermometer of what people think Bitcoin is worth. Just because the price on the exchange says $2 in some kind of freak incident doesn't mean that people worldwide are valuing Bitcoin as such. And it'll be a short blip because this is the situation they're talking about is like a 95% drop, you know, within 10 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, and just like absolute
chaos.
Fucking chaos.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then they don't think about cruise missiles and shit. So, like, why is all of a sudden now we're thinking, you know, death spiral's not going to happen.
Yeah. So that's what we got on the death spiral. But staying on mining in particular, CoinShares put out some Bitcoin mining research recently. Bitcoin Sign Guy was alluding to it with the different types of costs that these operations have. That was one piece. And then they did another piece on breaking down the energy consumption, the types of energy that Bitcoin miners are using. I will caveat this with I don't know how much I agree with the final numbers they came to. I think they're.
I love the numbers. The numbers,
I know,
are
you
fantastic.
Love the
numbers, huge support of
the numbers.
Numbers
are something like 77% of energy used to mine Bitcoin is renewable energy.
It's probably renewable energy.
It's probably, yes, but there are some people that are questioning the methods of the study. But you have some.
But even if they're off by 50%, like 25% is still fucking badass.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and everyone knows that excess renewable is the cheapest electricity. So it makes sense that they're going to be crowded around these types of situations. Here's Bitcoin Sign Guy.
Oh. Yeah, I was going to just agree with that. That even if the number is wrong, it's still likely directionally
yeah.
correct.
Yeah.
That's huge.
Yeah,
that's what I meant to say. It's directionally correct. I would assume.
I've been interested in the company Upstream Data lately. Good episode on Stefan.
SG Garber, is that his
Stefan
name?
Steve Barber.
Barber. That's what it is. Yeah.
He's making a miner skid that is inside a shipping container that can be sent wherever natural gas is being drilled. And right now, you know, they're just venting this methane into the atmosphere,
which is not good.
And so I believe the skid has an engine that burns the methane, generate the electricity on the spot, and then mines it back. So I don't know. I think oil and gas companies will be crucial players in Bitcoin infrastructure in the future, much as aluminum companies, aluminum refining companies are helpful now to, for those of you that don't know, aluminum refining is a highly energy intensive process. So aluminum refineries go where there's cheap excess energy, and it allows countries that are, not able to export their energy, they can export refined aluminum. Mm-hmm. I think this is the case in Iceland, but I may be off on the specifics there.
No, it's a very, very good point to make. And it's going to drive innovations in energy efficiency, energy consumption efficiency, and then renewable energy as well.
One of the arguments against CoinShares research paper was that Bitcoin miners are 24/7. So when the excess electricity from the renewables isn't running,
that's bullshit.
They use coal. They're not. But one of the reasons I bring this up is because upstream data is. There's two important things about upstream data, which BSG just mentioned, is that it uses excess methane, and that methane is worse for the environment if it's not burned. And a lot of regulations mandate that they burn it for waste. They don't even mine Bitcoin with it. They just burn it for waste. And then the second thing is those skids don't mine unless that excess methane exists. The second it stops venting, they stop mining. They're going on and off with cheap electricity. They want, as mining hard, right now mining hardware life cycle isn't that long because there's huge improvements all the time. So you're trying to like maximize as much money out of this piece of computer as possible before it goes obsolete. But as this plateaus, the main cost is going to be electricity, and they're going to want to maximize cheap electricity as much as possible, and they're going to be turning it off on and on, off and on.
Yeah, I'd go as far as to say that you could focus, if you're an equities investor, you could focus on companies like Exxon Mobil, Shell, Baker Hughes, Schlumberger, as these would be the presumptive purchasers of these skids in the future. Mm-hmm. Just anywhere along the oil and gas,
supply chain.
These are the companies that will be implementing Bitcoin mining to cut their costs and tighten their margins.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. The incentives of Bitcoin are beautiful. Satoshi created a beautiful incentive system.
The other thing is, like, do you think like the Venezuelan government's going to turn off their fucking miners when price falls? Like, what else are they going to do with the sanctioned oil? Like, they're going to just keep mining.
Yeah,
but that's for the previous conversation. But I just thought about that.
Also, beyond spare capacity in renewables and excess byproducts of shale gas drilling, etc., also keep in mind that we have what's known as the duck curve for urban energy production. So when people are home at night and they're running their heat or they're running their AC, they're using all their home appliances, the energy demand load, it spikes during the hours. During peak hours when people are home. And just regular urban power plants are left with the dilemma of, oh, well, we sort of need to phase out our generation during the day when not as much energy is being consumed. With Bitcoin, they could keep their machines running at full tilt and just turn them toward their Bitcoin mine and not the energy grid.
This is a discussion and topic I jumped into thoroughly with Joe Looney, who was the original creator of Rare Pepe. He's one of the original creators, and he actually worked in an energy facility and described this exact scenario. And I bet there's a bunch of people in that industry thinking about doing something like this.
Yeah, the duck curve. Look it up. It looks like a duck.
I love the name.
Ramp. What is Ramp?
Ramp is fucking badass.
What is it?
The Russian anonymous marketplace.
Okay.
Brendan Bernstein showed this to us.
Yeah.
So it's like the evolution of Silk Road. They've been trying to shut it down for a while. It's Russian specific, mm-hmm. hence the name. The biggest vulnerability of a dark marketplace is shipping it. You have to get the drugs shipped somewhere, the merchandise shipped somewhere, and that's usually connected to a name, address, camera, something, you know, video, CCTV will catch you. And that's an issue. That's, you know, on the payment side, you can pay with Bitcoin and you don't have to worry about much. But on the receiving side, you have an attack vector. So with Ramp, which is really fucking cool, is they hide like small parcels of drugs all around Russian cities. And when you make the purchase, they send you coordinates. So you can make a purchase on this marketplace and get your drugs within 30 minutes, you know, 40 minutes, like right away. And then they like send out runners like every day to like put it in new places and whatnot. And then they have an arbitrator. If there's some kind of dispute, the arbitrator with their whole review system and reputation system and everything. And I just think like that's, you know, like the cypherpunk future. Like it exists now.
Well, life finds a way.
Yeah, easy does it, Arjun Balaji. We're looking at you. We know you're a little G-cashing son of a gun.
No, but it, I don't want to be cheesy, but life does find a way. Like in these authoritarian governments, people are finding a way to make markets happen.
Well, we're going to have autonomous drones soon, but this is pretty fucking cool in the meantime.
Yeah, it's pretty dope too. Yeah, so the Russian
be aware
anonymous,
of it.
What is it?
The Russian anonymous marketplace,
okay,
aka Ramp.
Yeah, we'll link to that as well. Last topic,
we're not linking to the marketplace, we'll link to the article about
yes,
it.
We'll link to the article
actually just while I have this platform. I have a question. If some of the audience members know anything about this, can we please have a drone to drone delivery such that we can make onion routing for, you know, delivery of physical objects? I think that, I don't know, we need some protocol where there's some chip embedded in a package, and basically one drone can drop it off at a given coordinate and another drone can go pick it up. I think that closes the loop in many ways for us.
We are well known for our future business ideas, and I think this may be
the
best one
we've
created on this podcast.
There you go. $1 billion idea, folks.
So wait, any of you AI drone operators out there, here's the $1 million cypherpunk future idea.
You think it beats rentable toilets?
Yeah, totally beats Boober. Poober.
Airbnb, obviously.
Poober. Last topic.
I really like that idea, by the way. That's a good idea.
Last topic.
Let's get that built.
Perennial scammer Dan Larimer seems like he may be moving on to a fourth scam. He's had, well, some people will say...
No, it's like eighth.
Six or seven. Yeah, some people will say eighth. Or eight, excuse me. His three most famous to date are BitShares, Steemit, and EOS. And via the EOS communication channels, I believe it leaked that he announced that he's already working on a Bitcoin-like project.
Yeah, that $1 billion shitcoin, that's just a side hustle.
$5 billion. And this was this happened like the same day that it came out that Steemit like had failed miserably.
And they like fired 70% of their employees.
Yeah.
Because it's got a centralized
corporation.
So there's
scammers everywhere. I tweeted out months ago, I think in the beginning of the year, like any idiot dumb enough to fall for Dan Larimer's third scam deserves to get what's coming to them. So heed my advice this time. Don't fall for his fourth scam.
I just put this in here because it's fucking hilarious. Larimer is famously the person who Satoshi said, if you don't get it, I don't have time for you.
Yeah, I believe he said.
I just butchered the quote, but
yeah,
the famous
said, if you
quote.
You don't understand it. I don't have time to explain it.
It was great. It was just a great, and that he said that to Larimer, and Larimer he just launches hype scam after hype scam, and then he leaves them when they're like 70% done.
Yeah.
And then moves on to the next project. You know, I joked around that in 30 years, he's going to be 66 and he's going to be on like his 25th ICO. And it's going to be the most hype thing ever. And people are just going to give him billions of dollars.
Don't be a Larimer greater fool, freaks. Resist.
Yeah. And I just want to reiterate that Multicoin posted a bullish thesis at $18 for EOS and saw like 250 or something.
Beware. There's scammers everywhere. And be careful who you take advice from. Always verify. Do your own research. That's all the topics of this week, but I think we can riff off some other stuff. You guys have anything you want to talk about?
Yeah, I mean, Vake had a very important topic. Boxers or briefs?
Well, That's the wrong question. It's boxers, briefs, or neither.
So you're a
Bitcoin commando.
Bitcoin commando? No. I like that. That was BSG.
We're among everybody. You may not know who we are, but we exist.
I'm a boxer brief kind of guy. Nice, I think it's a nice balance in between.
Hey, Christmas is around the corner, freaks.
I like walking around my apartment naked, though, too. That's a plus.
I'm very liberated in my apartment as well. But, freaks, it's Christmas time. Matt is a briefs guy. I always like fresh underwear when I was wearing them around Christmas time. So, good gift.
Just buy Bitcoin just for yourself and just hold it.
Yeah, very high time preference.
Let's get ourselves to 6626 by January 1st. Otherwise, a very expensive dinner on my
plate. Well, we have one of the most eloquent speakers on the subject in the room. I feel like it would be a waste if we didn't get like a parting diatribe from Bitcoin Sign Guy. What's on your mind these days? How have things been since we spoke in July?
Things are well.
What do you think the state of Bitcoin is right now?
State of Bitcoin is strong. I don't know, the bear markets when people have the headspace to do what's necessary. The bull market almost is, you know, impossible to do anything during it because you're just posturing for the ramp capital blowing the top off.
Yeah. You optimistic or?
Yeah, I'm optimistic. I'm following the VanEck ETF pretty closely. I wish Jan and Gabor all the best. I think they had one of their SEC no votes depart the SEC since, and I think the SEC is getting a new person. And then they also had one commissioner changed their mind on their subject. So things are probably looking up in that regard.
Yeah, and Peter McCormick at What Bitcoin Did actually just interviewed the dissenting vote from that SEC decision, whichever one that was. So if you freaks want to go check that out and get a little peek into the mind of the SEC, you can do that there. That's all I got for this week, freaks. Anything else, Matt? Bitcoin Sign Guy?
Gabor is a badass.
Yeah, I like his Twitter
big
style.
Big fan of Gabor.
Shout out
at
Gabor.
At VanEck. You know, don't get your panties in a bunch. Don't get your boxers in a bunch over this ETF because they've been talking about this shit since 2013.
Yeah.
You know, and Bitcoin doesn't live or die based off this ETF. It will pump when the ETF ultimately gets approved. But, you know, it's not something that you should really concern yourself with. You should just be excited that you have this opportunity to potentially invest in a brand new asset that doesn't have an ETF yet. You know, like well, that is a super rare situation. And you know, every day that we get without an ETF is a day we get ahead of all those people who will buy after the ETF.
Very good point. Thank you, freaks, for joining us this week. I don't know if we're going to have a show next week. We're still trying to decide. I'm going on a trip.
Yes.
I'm going on a trip.
I look forward to this show every week. So you have to.
Okay. We'll make it happen.
We'll probably do it on Monday.
Okay. Yeah, we'll do it on Monday. All right. Peace and love, freaks.